as if she was waiting to catch something in the air.
"Little capless spy," the girl was saying. "Stinking whore!"
The line was running forward. Someone appeared in the corner of her eye with an unthinkably large bag of flour. Young people were ransacking the distribution warehouse, even pulling out the workers. Julie closed her eyes.
"Unmask them! Bourgeois rats! Drag them out!"
The shouting had a merry dancing quality, a French Pierrot two-step.
"Cleanly, quickly, cut off their heads!"
From where had this crowd appeared? She heard a rupture like a plane coming down to land, but it was only this electrified, heaving mass of people. Time was slipping away. Soon, it would be too late.
"Just shout the slogans," the girl beside her whispered. "Quickly, they're watching you. Oh, why are you so afraid?"
Was it the little girl with no shoes? But when she turned, she saw only a press of bodies and no sympathetic face. The queue no longer existed and had been reshaped by the crowd. Where were her ration coupons? Had somebody pulled them from her hand? No, they were still here, tucked in the pocket of her shirt. She felt nauseated and knew she would vomit. Where was the woman? What hideous flaw had they seen inside her? The crowd seemed to swell and hide her, separating her from the hysterical Red Guards. The mob was both a terror and safety. In its frenzy, it was evolving from hundreds of bystanders into a single entity, a snake with a thousand eyes twisting this way and that, searching with ever greater intensity, magnifying every speck of dirt within it. The snake wound its long neck around and around. When it found her, it lifted her right up and forced her through the crowd. "Don't be afraid," she thought. "This is not real." She found herself standing in another line. Was that her voice crying out? There were a dozen people with her, old women, mothers, and even girls, staring in shock. Red guards swaggered around them, pushing them to their knees. Julie felt a shock of pain as she hit the concrete. Momentarily, she became dissociated. She was watching from a few steps away. She was a part of the crowd and could see the targets and also herself. A girl, a different girl, was coming with scissors. She was yanking the heads back one by one and cutting off great clumps of hair.
"Disgusting bitches," the girl repeated.
Julie re-entered herself and felt the blinding snap of the scissors and then an alien likeness as a swath of her hair fell. "It's nothing," she thought. "Only I must not lose the ration coupons. Balut will be angry if I let them fall from my pocket." Other things began to happen. Someone said,
"Oh, this is the violinist! The stuck-up bitch whose father is a counter-revolutionary!"
They pulled her bag from her, turned it upside down, and the Beethoven score slid out in a wild flutter of pages. She heard crying and begging, the rough splitting of clothing, but Julie focused on the papers.
"I know this filth! Her mother is a rightist dog!"
They were laughing at it, stomping on it, pretending to sing from it. People had arrived with dripping buckets, and she saw streaks of black cutting through the air. They threw ink, or was it paint, on all the kneeling bodies. Julie bowed her head, and it was as if the jeering and the spitting had broken the surface. Everything was coming inside. The first 3, 5, 7 slaps made her cry out in pain and anger, but after that, there was a numbness, as she began to lose feeling. Time expanded, just as it had in Bingpai when she was a child, and her father was kneeling in the center of the room. She had wondered then why her father had not stood up. Why would they not let him rise? She thought of Ma, and what passed from mother to daughter, from husband to wife, from one beloved to another,
A bloodline. A touch. A virus. I was the one who opened old West's library, Julie thought, beginning to lose consciousness. It was my mistake, and it is destroying my parents' lives. Every slap, kick, and humiliation that I receive is one less for my mother. What am I inside? What is it they finally see? I'm talking to you, you little slut! They kept shouting. Her head was pulled back again. How did this dirty whore slip through? Confess who you are! They were screaming through their loudspeakers right into her ears, as if they wanted to deafen her. They slapped the side of her head over and over. Is it a crime to be myself? Is it a crime to disbelieve? She wanted to weep at her own slowness, her own naivete. The ink drying on her face made the skin tight and painful. All the other women were confessing to something. Julie seemed to be the only one still kneeling. She knew she was guilty, but she could not confess. Around her, the crowd gave the impression of expanding and rising in exultation. "Open your mouth, you demon!" More slaps, and now they kicked her, pulled her upright again, and now they tied her arms behind her, so that her wrists were high up, above her shoulders, and her head was nearly on the ground. Hours of practice, Julie thought deliriously. I have practiced and practiced. I have memorized thousands of hours of music. And what will this be? A tiny pearl of time soon to be dissolved. Julie could not hear. She saw faces all around her. She was aware of movement without noise. They seemed to think she was useless, an imbecile, and they turned their attention to the woman beside her, who was crying so hard she could no longer hold herself up. Pity overwhelmed Julie, and she saw darkness behind the woman. "That is the place I must get to," she thought. But paint, or was it ink, and sweat had gotten into her eyes, and she could not wipe them clean. It was unbearably hot. They would be back for her, but she could hear only murmuring, a quiet, and it protected her. "I am ready now," she thought, "to bring all these flowers for... I will find all the flowers, even if I must steal them from the hands of our great leader. I will lay them at Prokofiev's feet." She had given every bit of her soul to music. The words of Goethe's Faust returned to her. "How great a spectacle! How great! But that, I fear, is all it is." The quiet would show her the way out. Silence would expand into a desert, a freedom, a new beginning. She became aware of movement, and felt there was a great deal of space around her, a darkness that she took for asphalt, the road, or nighttime. Where were her arms? They seemed to have detached from her body and fallen away. "My fingers have gone to gather my hair," she thought, wanting to smile. "They have gone to pick up my beautiful hair." It was useless to try to open her eyes. They were crusted shut, and she had nothing to hold on to but a stabbing pain that seemed to come from deep inside her lungs. Piano music came, unidentifiable. How near it was! But no, the music was a prank. Who played the piano in times like these? Oh, she thought, as a trickle of water touched her eyes and then her lips. "My good hands have brought me water." She heard an echoing, and then it was as if the air changed pitch. A fog gave way to rain. Rain shaded into tone, tone into voices. And then one voice in particular, which she knew immediately and impossibly to be Kai. "No," she thought, the pain in her lungs increasing.
It is not good to fall into his hands. Again the sensation of movement. Then the road came away from her skin. Kai was with her. At the bottom of all these tangled impressions, she glimpsed a changed idea. Another way of loving someone that she had not experienced before. An attachment like that to a brother, to a friend, to a lover who could never be her lover. Of a musical soulmate, a companion who might have been a lifelong collaborator. It's a great pity, she thought, that we will never have the chance to play Sagan together, because we brought something to it that had never been heard before. David Oistrakh himself would have recognized us. It is the truthfulness and the shame, no, the solitude, that comes from being at odds with oneself. It is loneliness. Only that, Kai, she thought. Yes, if only it were Kai.
Yes, Julie, he said. The Red Guards have all gone now.
There was no more time. She was moving, and yet she was still on the road. She was kneeling, and yet she was lying in a dark, humid room. She heard Balut. She heard Flying Bear crying, and Kai saying that two of the women targeted in the struggle session were still on the road. They were dead. One, a professor of mathematics at Jiaotong, had been dragged along the pavement for a kilometer. Zhu Li pushed the noise out. It was coming at her not through her ears, but through a breeze against her arms, her hands. Someone watched her. She knew it could only be Sparrow. She knew she was safe, and could now open her eyes if she chose to. But she did not choose to. Silence had come to her. It did not try to connect all its pieces, to pretend they were part of the same thing. It didn't need to pretend. Silence saw everything, owned everything, eventually took everything. Red Guards came to the house. She heard them coming nearer and nearer. They came in, and things fell down, more shouting. They saw her and said they would come back. Someone was crying. It was the neighbor, Mrs. Ma. She cried, "Shame! Shame!" But at whom? Julie didn't know. She was afraid to guess. Shame was a corkscrew inside her, winding together the selfishness, the frivolity, the hollowness of what she was, until there was no more possibility of change. In the next existence, Julie decided, there would be more colors than in the human world. There would be more textures and varieties of time. This would be the world of Beethoven as he sat with his back to the audience, when he understood that sound was immaterial. It was nothing but an echo. The true music had always been inside. But take away music, take away words, and what would persist? One of her ears had been damaged. She longed for her mother and father. How brightly the core of herself flickered before her, just out of reach. "What are you?" she asked. "Where are you?" She sat up and realized it was night. She sat up again and again, imagining herself pushing aside the sheet, walking to the doorway, to the outer room, to the fresh air outside. Sparrow heard his cousin waking. He had fallen asleep in a chair beside her bed. She had already left the room and turned down the hallway before he fully opened his eyes. He could not move. She would see the posters that were drying on the kitchen table. Da Shan and Flying Bear had been forced to criticize Zhu Li, Swirl, and Wen the Dreamer. And these denunciations would be pasted up in the morning.
"Call her the daughter of rightest filth," Balut had instructed. "You have to. Just write it down. Don't look at me like that. It's nothing. Only words.
Da Shan smudged the ink, and his father threw out the poster and made him do it again.
Da Shan, he said, if you don't denounce Zhu Li, they'll only make it worse for her. They'll turn around and say she's a demon, that she infiltrated our lives. Let them humble us, if that's what they want. Isn't it better to be humbled? Do you want your poor father, your brothers, to lose their lives?
Trembling, the teenager dipped his brush. Carefully he wrote Zhu Li's name. Ba Lut had now been summoned to the conservatory twice, where the struggle sessions had lasted a full 12 hours. Their neighbor, Mr. Ma, had disappeared, and so had Zhu Li's teacher, Tan Hong.
The criticism I receive is very light, compared to the others,
Ba Lut said when he returned. He had bruises all over his body. One eye was swollen shut, and his face was bloodied and lopsided. But his accusers, his own pupils at the conservatory, had left his hands alone. People who had been labeled rightists in earlier campaigns, even those who, like Swirl, had been rehabilitated, were far less fortunate. Twice, Sparrow had been taken away by a group of Red Guards. They had locked him in a storeroom at the conservatory, but nobody had come to criticize him or denounce him. Eventually the door was opened, and he was sent away. It was as if he floated under water, inside a bubble of air. On the streets, the students sang and wept and shouted their love. The targets, who had been humiliated once, were humiliated again and again, as if a familiar face elicited the most hatred. They were the ones to blame for the receding promise of modernity. The violent sacrifices of revolution, this malevolence that seemed to infect the very young. Only, it was not malevolence. It was courage, and they were loyal soldiers defending the chairman. Sparrow had to protect Zhu Li. He had to find a hiding place, but where? His father had said the violence was most extreme at the universities. The radio proclaimed that, in Beijing, the writer Fu Lei, once celebrated for his translations of Balzac and Voltaire, was being subjected to daily struggle sessions alongside his wife. The family's books had all been burned, and the piano destroyed. Their son, the pianist Fu Song, had applied for and received political asylum in the West. The father, Fu Lei, the quiet trader, the poisonous needle wrapped in a silk cover, was finally being called to account. The morning grew hotter. When Sparrow woke again, Zhu Li was sitting in bed, under the window. She had left a space for her mother, as a Swirl might arrive home at any moment. With her hair cut off, she looked even younger than she was.
"It's okay," she said. "You can go back to sleep."
I wasn't sleeping.
He sat up in his chair, rubbed his face, pushing his uneasy dreams away.
"No, I was only thinking."
"I'm fine now, and I know when you're telling fibs."
He smiled. One hand drifted up to the opposite arm, rising to her shoulder, finding the ends of her hair.
6 months, Zhu Li said in a low voice. "And everything will grow back."
She gazed at him, the dark smudges on her face. The bruising, which had turned a sickly yellow, made her appear shadowed despite the sunlight in the room.
"Sparrow, have you seen my violin?"
"Your violin?"
he said, stupidly. She waited, watching him.
"Zhu Li,"
he said. He despised the quaver in his voice and pushed it down.
"It was destroyed."
She nodded, as if waiting for the second half of the sentence. He looked at her helplessly.
It was destroyed.
It was, she said. But then...
Red guards came yesterday. No, it was 2 days ago. They came and smashed all the instruments. They even came in here, but Ba... We asked them to leave. Balut was denounced. He had to go to a meeting, but it's finished now. He's home. The conservatory is closed. Maybe for good.
Julie nodded. She seemed, to Sparrow, almost unbearably lucid. Where are Dashan and Flying Bear? She asked.
In Zhejiang, with Ba's cousin. Mrs. Ma took them by train. You need to go as well.
Yes, she said,
and then so flippantly he didn't quite believe she had spoken.
I should have studied agriculture after all. Cousin, haven't you been listening to the radio? The campaign is everywhere. Zhejiang will be no different from here.
He did not tell her that four professors at the conservatory had killed themselves in the last week, and that Professor Tan had been locked in a room without adequate food or light. Julie did not mention the denunciations Da Shan had written. A wave of chanting overran the streets, but they acted as if they did not hear it. It moved along Beijing Road, circling them. Julie asked if he had seen Kai.
I saw him 2 days ago. I couldn't tell how he was.
But he'll be protected, won't he? Nobody will harm him. They won't harm you.
The feeling in her voice came from another time, an old longing that did not know how to fade. He didn't know what to do but nod. She closed her eyes.
I'm glad, cousin.
When she spoke again, her voice was very calm.
I'm glad, she said.
She touched her hair again, and then let it go.
It's like morning, when the stars are painted over by daylight, Sparrow. You think it's very far away, all this light. And anyway, there's a great universe of stars and other things, and so you never believe they'll disappear. Sparrow, of all the things they say I am, they are right that I am proud. I was proud to be myself. I really did believe that one day I would play before the chairman himself, that I would go to London and Moscow and Berlin.
She laughed, like a child at the antics of a little pet.
I know now. Those places will only ever be words to me. My pride was so great, I imagined that I would stand in a room where Bach lived. I would see his handwriting, his rooms, and his little bed, and I would show people what it meant to me. They would hear it. They would hear Bach in me. They would know that he was mine, too. I don't know how. I don't know why.
The lucidity in Duri's eyes frightened him.
There's a joke inside of it, Julie said. That's why everyone laughs at me. Do you understand? All these things that we don't have are nothing compared to the things we did have. A life can be long or short, but inside it, if we're lucky, is this one opening. I looked through this window and made my own idea of the universe, and maybe it was wrong. I don't know anymore. I never stopped loving my country, but I wanted to be loyal to something else, too. I saw things. I don't want the other kind of life.
Sparrow stood and went to close the door that was already closed. He went to the window, which was latched tight. He drew the curtains and tried to think of what to do.
Tomorrow, he said, I'll take you to Zhejiang. You won't be alone. Flying Bear and Dashan...
No,
she said. It would only cause trouble for them.
But what option was there? It was unbearable that there should be no escape.
Think, he told himself. You must think clearly.
The notebook, pen, and cup beside the bed drew his attention, and he slid the pen aside and picked up the notebook. He was shaking. The sight of Wooden the Dreamer's handwriting disturbed him. Where was Big Mother? Where was Swirl? They alone, not he or his father, knew how to protect her. He despised his own weakness.
Julie, he said, this disturbance will end. It must end.
My poor father. What will he feel when he comes home and sees what has happened to us all?
He didn't answer, and Julie reached her hand to him, to the notebook.
I finished this one. Let's continue. Chapter 17. It's your favorite chapter, isn't it? Here's the box, under the bed. I had to hide it from Balut.
He lifted the box out. Julie combed her hands through her hair, as if preparing to receive a visitor. She said,
I have this idea that, maybe a long time ago, the Book of Records was set in a future that hadn't yet arrived. That's why it seems so familiar to us now. The future is arriving. We've come all this way to meet it.
Or maybe, he said, it's we who keep returning to the same moment.
Next time, we'll meet in another place. Won't we, Sparrow?
Yes, Julie.
Sparrow read the chapter aloud as afternoon became evening, as if reading from the Book of Records was the same as shutting and bolting the outside door. Inside the room, Thaway would soon leave America and return home. But before his departure, a composer named Cho brings him to a rehearsal at Carnegie Hall. 100 musicians radiate from the central figure of the conductor, Edgar Varèse, and meanwhile, a second, smaller orchestra plays from an adjoining room, alternating and colliding, audible but invisible to one another. They perform a single symphony using drums, alarms, scraps of songs, sirens, a shouting flute, the bang and clank of metropolitan horns. The pandemonium of the symphony is the most beautiful thing Thaway has ever heard. It seems simultaneously to include him and usher him on his way.
Thaway, you mustn't go back,
Cho tells him afterwards.
It's too late to return.
Thaway does not know how to answer. Before him, the orchestra has vacated the stage, but their music stands wait like a flock of cranes.
Myself, Cho says. I left Shanghai during the worst of the fighting. The Japanese pursued us, but we managed to disappear into a crowd.
His face, so alive in its story, turned gray.
The army apprehended another group, mistaking them for us. They rounded them up and shot them all. They were massacred. You see how it is. A life for a life. I can never go back.
In the chamber, it feels as if all the hundreds of chairs are inclined towards them, listening.
I tell you, our country has no need for us. You and I, we're all Yimin, altered people, which is to say, we will soon be the most common people in existence.
When the chapter ended, Julie took the notebook in her hands. She said,
I have never heard Varèse. I've heard so little modern music from the 20th century. I wish one day I could go abroad and listen to what they're hearing.
She said as if she hadn't realized until this moment,
Thaway is the shadow of my father. All these years, because of the handwriting, I imagined he was writing to us directly. To me. It was never just a book, was it? Sparrow, promise me. don't let Balut burn the notebooks.
Yes, Julie. I promise.
Nearly 3,000 kilometers away, Wen the Dreamer arrived in Yumen City, Gansu Province. Since his escape from Jiangbian Guo, he had crossed and recrossed the northwest for nearly 2 years. No longer the same bookish young man with poems folded into his pocket. In his mid-40s, darkened by the sun and burned by the wind, old before his time, he was lithe, alert, and physically toughened. He stole the identity cards of passing strangers, thereby changing his name on a monthly basis. He stopped when necessary to earn money or ration coupons by working in a wheat or millet field or a cement factory. With his battered suitcase, he crossed and recrossed the desert, learning how to live in the dry moonscape of Gansu province, how to evade capture, and how to exist on air alone. One day, he found in a book barrow in Xinjiang a copy of Chapter 6 of the Book of Records. He stared at the pages, fearing that he was lost, hallucinating that Da Wei, May 4th, and the Book of Records was a myth, an allegory, or a system around which all their lives were knotted. Seeing his distress, the child tending the book barrow said,
"My father read that book. He got it from our cousin. He doesn't have the whole book, though, just a few chapters. This one's extra. He won't sell the rest."
"Where does your cousin live?"
The child raised her faint eyebrows.
"Jincheng. He works in the nickel mine."
That night, Wen read the notebook without a pause, devouring it as if it were a plate of food, convinced with each turning of the page that he knew the handwriting and would always know it. In this copy, a secondary character's name had been altered. The copyist had used the character Wei, which was the Wei of Wei River, whose source was in Gansu province. He traveled to Jincheng, a town made curious by its scattered buildings of foreign design, said to be the ruins of Roman-style houses left by 1,000 exiled soldiers who settled there 2,000 years ago. Their descendants were occasionally born with green eyes and startling red hair. These days, the town was more famous for its nickel and precious metals. In Jincheng, he found another chapter, also mimeographed, dated only 6 weeks previous, and using the same code. The owner of the book barrow was reticent, but finally he confided that he received the chapter from a honeydew farmer in Lanzhou. Wen the Dreamer followed the trail, down half a dozen roads and chapters, until, one day, he knocked at the door of Notes from the Underground, the plant and flower clinic of the Lady Dostoevsky.
"My dear man," the lady said, "it's about time. I was sure I would be dead by the time you finally got here."
She told him that Swirl was in Yumen City with her sister, where the two women worked in the local song and dance troupe. As she left, she pressed into his hands the copy of The Rain on Mount Ba, which had once belonged to his daughter, and still had Zhu Li's handwriting in the margins. A week later, Wen the Dreamer appeared in Yumen, thin as a spear of grass. He came to the simple dwelling Lady Dostoevsky had described, where Swirl lived with Big Mother Knife. Lamplight flickered behind the curtain. He stood outside with his suitcase for a long time, afraid to let her see him, afraid to imagine the cessation of his loneliness, afraid of the future and also the past. He remembered how he used to watch Swirl's window in Shanghai, waiting for the lamp to be extinguished so that he could deliver a new chapter of the Book of Records. A lifetime ago. 2 lifetimes.
Now all the copies held a record of the places they'd been, the places they'd been forced to leave. He had tried to clip his hair, to clean himself and mend his clothes, but still he felt the uncrossable sea between who he was and who he might have been. When he tapped lightly on the frame of the window, Swirl came to the door and opened it. She stared at him, as if at an apparition. Wun the dreamer recited the famous line of Li Bai. See the waters of the Yellow River leap down from heaven. Roll away to the sea, never to turn again.
Destined, Swirl answered, to return to a swirl of dust.
Big Mother, who was standing behind Swirl at the door, came out. Calmly, as if he came by every evening, she embraced him. And then she wrapped herself in a sweater and left them alone. She walked for a long time along the nearby ridge. Lamps from the oil refinery illuminated a web of nighttime workers. The sky was dark purple, filled with foreboding. When Big Mother returned, she saw her sister and Wun standing side by side in the shadows of the house. The stars were dimming, and she had the sense that night sky was loosening from the earth and lifting away. Not once did Big Mother see them bend or move, let alone touch one another. After having been separated for a decade, they stood so lightly, as if the ground itself could not be trusted. Maybe they talked about how, in a house like Ba Lut's, in the home of a party hero, their daughter might have a chance to thrive. Maybe they spoke not of Judy, but of something else entirely, of other intimacies and unwritten lives. It was for the wind to hear, Big Mother later told Sparrow, and not for the likes of her. When the dreamer and Swirl left in the night, in a bid to escape to the borderlands, Mongolia could be reached in 2 days, and Wun had contacts who could help them on the other side. The following morning, Big Mother began a letter to Zhuli, her good eye right up to the page. She would find a way to send it, along with letters from Swirl and Wun, once she felt it was safe to do so. My heart has been heavy all day long, she thought, remembering the poem she had recited at her sister's wedding. Your elder sister has looked out for you, and now you are both crying and cannot part. Yet it is right that you should go on. In the letter to Zhuli, she wrote, I watched them depart on one small horse. Can you imagine? As if they were young again. Her tears wrinkled the page. She folded the letter and hid the words away. That evening, she went to the local party secretary and told them her sister had slipped and fallen into the Wei River. She had tried to save Swirl, but the current had been too strong. The fetid water, polluted with waste from the factories, had carried her away. The party secretary convened a search team. After 5 days, with no sign of the body, and anxious about rising production quotas and the new political campaign, he pronounced Swirl dead, signed her papers, and closed her file. In Shanghai, Sparrow was taken away by Red Guards, and for a week they had no word of him. A different group came for Zhuli on Tuesday and Wednesday, and then left her alone until Sunday. Sunday was the worst, and the Red Guards came again on Monday. On Tuesday, Sparrow came home, starving and exhausted, but unharmed. He'd been held in isolation in a storage room, and then let go. It was inexplicable. On the streets, loudspeakers blared from every corner. The official news program announced that Lao She, whose plays Wun the Dreamer had loved and who had once been celebrated as the people's artist, had drowned himself.
To celebrate his death, joyful marching music danced from the speakers. In the middle of the broadcast, Red Guards entered the house. Despite Sparrow's begging, despite his grip on Julie, they took her. Her hand slipped out of his. In truth, the fear in Sparrow's voice had so terrified her, Julie had closed her eyes and pulled her hand free. At first, Julie's classmates had been inventive. They had new slogans and methods. They had new implements like garbage pails, conductor's batons, and razors. There was a comedic quality to it all. One laugh crashing down onto the next, explosive laughter, barbed laughter, tripwire laughter. Questions that were not questions. The confessions they wanted that had nothing to do with confession. On and on they sang. The water of socialism nourished me. I grew up beneath the red flag. I took the oath to dare to think, to speak up, to act, to devote myself to revolution. They loved to sing. It was the way they looked at her, the utter implacability, the contempt she couldn't bear. The revolutionaries soon lost interest in their own implements, and now they beat her with their bare hands. Kai had said she had always cared more about music and her desires than about the party. He said he had tried to instruct her on the correct works, even going so far as to copy them out by hand for her, but she had rejected them. Her parents were enemies of the people, and Julie refused to denounce them. She was loose and had no morals. She was degenerate. All passions should be subsumed to revolution, he said. He talked and talked and would not stop, but he never mentioned Sparrow's name and never betrayed him. When he ran out of words, he left and did not come back. After this, she felt she understood everything. Music began with the act of composition, but she herself was only an instrument, a glass to hold the water. If she answered the accusations or defended herself, she would no longer be able to hear the world that was finally seeping into her. Loud, strange music. She kept turning her head to try to place this second orchestra, this outer room, and meanwhile, the revolutionary youth kept trying to make her face forward and look at the floor. She saw their hands, shouting, and their mouths smiling. Silently, she berated herself. Animals, she thought, do not weep. Instead, they never look away. That day, Sparrow brought her home. He couldn't stop weeping, and she realized she'd never seen him fall apart, and it frightened her. But he was safe, she thought. The Red Guards had not harmed him. She thought that Kai was protecting him. Always, the pianist was just behind Sparrow, watchful, but perhaps it was all in her mind. Still, some link between the three of them could never be broken. It was the future that was to have been. If only the country had chosen a different path. She wanted to ask Kai so many questions. She wanted to tell him that whatever happened, whatever they chose, one day they would have to come awake. Everyone would have to stand up and confront themselves, and realize that it wasn't the party that made them do it. One day they would be alone with their actions. She wanted to tell him, don't let them hurt your hands, your gifted hands. She wanted to tell Sparrow, no matter what happens, you must finish your symphony. Please don't let it disappear. Did it matter more to love or to have been loved? If anyone answered her question, she didn't catch the words. I am so far away now, Julie thought, that words dissolve before they reach me. How far is that? She thought.
She felt terribly alone. How much farther? With Da Shan and Flying Bear away in Zhejiang, the Laneway house was quiet. On Thursday, she woke very early, as she used to do. The inky darkness of the night protected her as she put on her favorite blue dress, pinned the rough edges of her hair aside, gathered what she needed, and slipped through the front door. The gods of silence protected her, and neither Sparrow nor her uncle woke. Or if they did wake, they chose not to stop her from leaving. The night was a dream, a pure warmth that settled on her and seemed to ease her awake. She could barely walk, and yet nothing hurt. She took side streets and alleyways to the conservatory, and the journey lasted a long time. Small fires burned. She came to an intersection that was piled high with books. They looked as if they had been overturned from a truck. They made a shape like a sand dune. Here and there were groups of students sleeping outside. One woke and watched her passing, but seemed to think Zhu Li was part of her dream. The Red Guard gazed at her and did nothing. There were posters everywhere, a mute shouting that surrounded Zhu Li, but no longer frightened her. She did not know how or why, but now that she understood, now that she had come to a decision, the old fears had drained away. Asleep, the revolutionaries appeared innocent. They seemed as nothing. Zhu Li walked and saw buildings, littered streets, damaged lights, scraps of clothing, broken furniture. She felt the hardness of the pavement, the blue-black air, and even the weightlessness of her dress. No matter which way she turned, the roads twisted and led her to the conservatory. This had always been the course of her life. Past the gate, the courtyard was alive with shapes, small and large piles of trash, which she moved between as if they were rows of empty seats. The conservatory door had been propped open with a shoe. She did not know why, but she left the shoe in place, nudged the door wider, and went inside. She thought she saw abandoned programs, lost handbags, forgotten coats, and then, after a moment, the hallucination passed, and she came to the staircase she had first climbed when she was a child, when Sparrow, holding her hand, had brought her to study with Professor Tan. The conservatory smelled of both damp and fire, a smell that seemed, as she moved through the building, to be coming from the workshop where Professor Tan had built violins using thin boards of parasol tree wood. Zhu Li stopped and looked in the door, thinking perhaps there was a violin that she could take with her and play, a violin that she could make her own. But there was nothing. Bits of wood looked as if they had been flung in joyous celebration at the windows. She went on. At the fourth floor, she turned down the hallway and saw the same posters that Kai had shown her many weeks ago. Zhu Li began to pull them down. Witch. It was slow and noisy work. The papers made a terrible noise, but it no longer mattered. There were so many. The posters seemed to proliferate as she moved them. She took out the red marker she had slipped into her pocket and stood before the last poster, ready to strike. But the hallway was so rigidly devoid of life, she could not think of any words. Once Debussy had trickled through the walls. She heard it now, again, and was grateful. It was as if all the gods were gathering. They had come to meet her here. What had become of He Luping and all the rest? The parents of Fu Song had taken poison and killed themselves. It was being celebrated. The rest must have gone away somewhere. Had the older generation seen everything coming and quietly dissolved before the hammer fell? She hoped so. She lifted the marker again and wrote the only words that came to her.
She did not put down the writer's name, Shen Chongwen, or the novel, Border Town. The marker moved, as if of its own accord. This is what is in my mind, she thought. Another person's words. The old ferryman couldn't guess what the obstacle was, or how to fix it. He'd lie in bed, mulling it over, until finally it began to occur to him that perhaps Chu Chu loved the younger brother, not the elder. That made him smile, an unnatural smile from fear. In truth, he was a little worried, because it suddenly occurred to him that Chu Chu was like her mother in every way. He had a vague feeling that mother and daughter would share the same fate. Events of the past swarmed into his mind, and he could no longer sleep. He ran out the door alone, onto the high bluffs by the creek. He looked up at the stars and listened to the katydids and sounds of the other insects, constant as rain. He could not sleep for a very long time. She wrote directly over top of the denunciations on the poster, so that brother appeared over leader, vague over reactionary, and high bluffs sat over top demon-exposing mirror. Borrowed words over borrowed words. They were all attached to one another now. She turned and saw the soft shapes of paper on the floor. They had been blunted by falling, and the words, which had looked like joints, turned out to have no weight at all. She dropped the red marker on the floor and felt consoled by its sharp clatter, and went on, down the hallway, until she came to the office that Sparrow shared with old Wu. The door was closed, but unlocked, and Zhu Li felt lightened as she entered the room. Nobody had ransacked the office. The records and books, few as they were, the portraits of Chairman Mao, Premier Zhou Enlai, and Vice-Premier Liu Shaoqi. Everything remained neat and ordered, as if they belonged to another time and place. She stared at the portraits and saw her own shadow in the glass. There she was finally completely visible, the girl and the sky and fate twisted together.
"Sparrow will understand," she told herself, knowing that it was not true. But maybe he would understand. There was a devil inside her, and Zhu Li had no choice. She had to protect it. She could not let them restrain it. She laid some of her cousin's records on the floor and studied them. "My first sentence was, 'Make revolution.' Mahler's fifth. Bach's Goldberg variations. Prokofiev's fifth. Beethoven's Emperor. I took the oath to dare to think, to speak up, to act." She did not want to hear a violin, and so the record she put on was Bach. She wanted to walk slowly. There was no longer any need to rush. Time extended inside Bach. There were repetitions and canons. There were circles and spirals. There were many voices and honest humility, as if he knew that reincarnation and loss were inseparable. The music no longer seemed to come from the record player, but from some chamber of her memory. She thought of Kai, and then resolved to think of him no more. In her mind, she feared most for Sparrow, because she knew him as well as she knew herself. He would let his talent burn away. He dared not admit that talent was a precious thing. She wanted to tell her mother and father that she had come to a high plateau from where she could see in every direction, and she wasn't afraid. It wasn't fear she was walking away from, but discontinuity. She could not stand the loneliness. In this brief window when she still knew who she was, before they broke her down again, she wished to choose a future and to leave. How could she put these thoughts in a note? She wanted to preserve the core of herself. If they took away music, if they broke her hands, who would she be? A note would be taken up by the Red Guards. A note would only cause further humiliation. She had a strong belief that Wun the Dreamer was alive, that Swirl and Big Mother Knife were safe, and a fervent desire that they understand her choice. When she had turned the record over and both sides had finished playing, she took the rope from her coat pocket, removed her shoes, climbed up onto Sparrow's desk, careful not to disrupt his papers. She attached the rope to a long pipe that ran along the wall. She climbed down and pushed the desk away, keeping the chair where it was. She looped and carefully tied the rope. It was very quiet, and she wondered if she should say something, if she should speak and make a noise. Julie did not mean to weep, but it was beyond her. This body and its responses, this body and its desires. She thought of the hidden library. She opened the lid and looked inside. She saw the ancient instrument on which she had first learned to listen. She thought of Sparrow, how young he was when he had opened the door that let her into this life. Was it possible to walk away, to abandon him and, at the same time, to protect him? The first aria of the Goldberg Variations was also its end. Could it be that everything in this life had been written from the beginning? She could not accept this. "I am taking this written record with me," she thought. "It is mine, and I'm the only one who can keep it safe." She let go. Sparrow woke in the dark, aware of the front door opening. It seemed to remain open for a long time before finally, almost imperceptibly, shutting. Sparrow felt as if he were groping through a dream that still continued. He had to shoulder through it. He had to make it burn away. The dream involved men walking on a frozen river and machetes hacking through the ice. Finally, it broke. He opened his eyes, and the shape beside him became the outline of a window. An elongated figure widened into a bookshelf. He reached for the thin cover, but it had already fallen away. After a moment, he stood up and, careful not to creak the floorboards, went to the room that Julie shared with Aunt Swirl. He touched the empty bed. Julie had gone to see the old cat. He did not know how he knew this. He could think of no other reason for Julie to break curfew. The bed still seemed warm from his cousin's body. In the stickiness of the hot night, his shirt had glued to his back. Sparrow poured water into Julie's basin and washed his face. When he caught sight of his reflection, he was surprised at his thinness. Had he fallen ill, he wondered? Had he lost weeks or months of time? In the glass, he looked as if he were still a young man, almost a student. He pondered his reflection, half expecting it to vanish. Back in his room, he changed his clothes. He pulled one of Da Shan's red armbands over his left sleeve. The armband would make him invisible. Once more, he ran his hands over his face and looked into the glass. There were voices drifting in through the closed window. Young men, Red Guards, it seemed, in the alleyway. Sparrow could hear the detritus of a fire being kicked and smothered. He could smell burning. They were singing softly, as if they were suddenly concerned about the residents of the laneway and did not wish to wake them. Slowed down beats of music, dreaming auras of song. A young man's pure, strong tenor sliding off the walls of the alleyway. "This is the beautiful motherland. This is the place where I grew up." Later on, Sparrow came to know that he had taken the rope from around his cousin's neck. He had somehow managed to gather Zhu Li in his arms,